Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Rick Atkinson has just published the second volume of his American Revolution trilogy. The book is called The Fate of the Day. It covers the years 1777 to 1780. His initial 800-page volume titled The British Are Coming was published in 2019 and focused on the years 1775 to 1777. This new book in the trilogy covers the middle years. Stationed in Paris, Benjamin Franklin was wooing the French. In Pennsylvania, George Washington was pleading with Congress to deliver the money, men, and material he needed to continue the fight. Rick Atkinson is the number one New York Times bestselling author of seven previous works of history, including The Long Gray Line, The Liberation Trilogy, An Army at Dawn, The Day of the Battle, and The Guns at Last Light. He has won many awards, including the Pulitzer Prize for both history and journalism. This volume is timed to coincide with the 250th anniversary of the beginning of the American Revolution before a live audience in Saratoga Springs, just 9.4 miles away from the Saratoga battlefield. We welcome Rick Atkinson to the Book Show. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks for having me.
I'm wondering at what point in the process you decided or knew that this was going to be a trilogy.
Right from the beginning. I'd written a trilogy about the American role in the liberation of Europe in World War II. That book cleaved naturally into three theaters, North Africa, Sicily and Italy, and then Western Europe. As I was finishing that book, before it was published, in fact, thinking about what to do next, the obvious thing would have been to pivot to the Pacific and do for that theater what I'd done for the Mediterranean and Europe. I didn't have the heart for it, to be honest with you. And I began contemplating what else to do. I thought about Jack London's advice that a writer ought not sit back and wait for inspiration, but ought to light out after it with a club. So I took my club, and what I found was the revolution, which I've been fascinated by since I was a kid. Right from the beginning, I saw it essentially as a three-volume story. That's just the way I see the story cleaving naturally, narratively.
And once you have that, my God, you have a pretty impressive cast of characters to deal with, don't you?
Yes, yeah. And it's one of the great pleasures of writing about that era. The cast of characters is beyond the capacity of any novelist imagination. Tolstoy couldn't come up with this group. And it, you know, ranges from Benedict Arnold, whom I've been interested in since I was an eighth grader at George S. Patton Junior High School in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. My father was an Army officer. And I discovered Benedict Arnold then. And I thought, well, this guy has some issues. And it turns out he's the best tactical commander on either side the first 2 years of the war. A man born to lead other men in the dark of night. And then it goes from there. I spend a lot of time on the other side of the hill trying to understand George III, your last king, and Lord North, his prime minister, and Lord Sandwich, the head of the Admiralty, and why they're waging war against their own people for 8 years, as it turns out, across 3,000 miles of open ocean in the Age of Sail. So that's a wonderful cast. And then, of course, George Washington is the long pole in the tent. He's the inescapable man. He's the fellow that it all rides on. And, I think I see him pretty well as a general and as a man. I see that he's got feet of clay like all of us. I see that he's not a particularly good tactician. He's got a molten temper. He feels sorry for himself on more than one occasion. And yet he's got capacities that are extraordinarily important to ultimately winning our independence. So yes, it's a vast cast, and it gets bigger and bigger because the war gets bigger. We go from this brush fire on the edge of the civilized world, an insurrection against the British Empire. And in this book, it becomes a global war. It's fought on four continents and the seven seas. The French are going to come into it. The Spanish are going to come into it. Eventually the Dutch are going to come into it. It becomes not only an existential war for us, looking us meaning Americans, looking for our independence, it's existential for the British because they're facing a whole continent full of enemies, and they are alone. They're by themselves. They have no allies other than tiny Portugal. So yeah, it's a wonderful canvas to have to paint on.
You write in the book, the conflict had metastasized into something far bigger, bloodier, and more pretentious than a revolt by disgruntled provincials. And we start to see that in this volume.
The game, when this book opens in the spring of 1777, and it opens in Versailles. And it opens in Versailles, where the first person you meet is Marie Antoinette, the Queen of France, known around the French court as Madame Deficit. And I'm introducing her and her husband, Louis XVI, because the game for the Americans at this point is to persuade the French, a Roman Catholic absolute monarchy, that it's in the best interest of the French to come into the war wholehearted, with both feet, on behalf of Protestant wannabe Republicans intent on insurrection against their lawful monarch. That's a heavy lift diplomatically. And the guy responsible for making that happen is Benjamin Franklin, who has arrived in France. He's a septuagenarian at this point. He's arrived in France in December 1776, and his job is to persuade Louis and the French court, including the French foreign minister, whose name is Vergennes, that they ought not just be giving us clandestine arms, munition shipments, and so on in secret, but they need to provide an army and a navy. You know, Franklin is our first and greatest diplomat, and he makes this happen. And when that happens, those two battles at Saratoga happen, that persuades the king and his ministers that the Americans are capable of doing this. They agree to Franklin's request for formal treaties, formal assistance, big time. We don't win independence in 1783 without the French. And one of the things that Franklin teaches us is that the best team usually wins. We know this from both world wars. We know it from throughout our history. In the Revolution, we had the best team. And we ought to remember that the next time we're giving a thumb in the eye to our closest friends. We're going to need those friends.
Rick Atkinson is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new book is The Fate of the Day, The War for America. You mentioned, while we were talking about characters, of course, oh yeah, Benjamin Franklin, a character. And I'm interested in what you just described of having that good team. They obviously didn't know that going in. We look at that through reflection and through history. What was it about him that made him so good at brokering that moment?
Well, he's the most famous American by far in the world as a consequence of his scientific discoveries in the 1740s, 1750s. He's a major scientist. He's been given an honorary doctorate from Oxford. He's Dr. Franklin. And when he arrives in Paris in December 1776, he's a rock star. People run after his carriages. People have little busts of Franklin on the mantles of their houses. They have Franklin wears this kind of ratty marten skin cap. He got it on a diplomatic mission to Canada that hadn't gone quite so well. And soon all the ladies in Paris are wearing little faux marten skin caps on their huge headdresses. He likes it. I mean, he really enjoys the adulation, and he plays it for all it's worth. And he recognizes that his personal popularity is a way to influence the French court. There is a natural predisposition among the French, both the aristocracy, but just among normal French people who are enthused for the what they perceive to be the efforts of the Americans to assert themselves on behalf of the rights of man. It really inflames them. And Franklin is going to play this for all it's worth, and he's going to use this to his advantage. And he's going to persuade the king. The French have lost the last war. They fought four dynastic wars against the British beginning in the 17th century. And in the most recent of those wars, the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War as we call it, the French had been demolished. And they had lost Canada. They'd lost a half billion fertile acres in America west of the Appalachians. They'd lost rich sugar islands in the West Indies where the real money is. They'd lost parts of India. And they are determined, beginning with Louis XVI, to reassert themselves and recapture the grandeur that was France and their role as the preeminent power on the European continent. And Franklin's argument to them is, if you want to stick it to the British, the best way to do that is with the Americans, who are already sticking it to the British. It's the enemy of my enemy is my friend. This is a very persuasive argument. Turns out to be quite correct. And the French make the decision that it's in their national interest, it's in their imperial interest to come into the war full bore.
You spoke of where the book begins. You frame the book with two British victories, one at New York's Fort Ticonderoga to our north, and also in Charleston, South Carolina, which is 3 years later. So give us an idea of that window, basically bringing us even from France to then where we are in Fort Ticonderoga.
Yeah, Joe. I mean, the book opens with the British sending an army out of Canada. They call it the Canada Army. It's under General John Burgoyne. They're coming down Lake Champlain. You all know the terrain here quite well. And the intent is to get into the Hudson River Valley and to come as far south, at least as Albany, and maybe all the way to New York, so that they can cleave the New England colonies away from the Mid-Atlantic colonies. This is not a bad plan. And the 8,000 German and British troops come down Lake Champlain. They rout the garrison that's at Ticonderoga. There's a bloody battle fought at Hubbardton, and they're in the Hudson River Valley. They arrive at Fort Edward. This is in the midsummer of 1777, and they start south. The only problem with the plan is the main British army is in New York under General William Howe, and the original plan had been for Howe to move north up the Hudson and meet Burgoyne, perhaps in Albany, and seal off New England, where the troublemakers are headquartered. And Howe decides he's going to go the other direction. He goes 180 degrees the other way. He decides that Philadelphia is where the war is to be won. And so, and who is adjudicating these conflicting visions? In London, no one, as it turns out. The plans are presented to Lord George Germain, a former British general, who is the American secretary. He's the Robert McNamara of the war. He's directing the war from London. And he basically signs off on both plans. It's strategically incomprehensible. As Burgoyne comes farther and farther south, his lines of communication, his supply lines, which go all the way back to Montreal, get thinner and thinner and thinner. And he's very hard up for fodder for his horses. 4,000 horses will eat 20,000 tons of hay and oats a year. That's a lot of hay and oats. And he can't gather it in the Hudson River Valley, can't gather it from around here, because every time they try, they get ambushed. He sends a detachment, mostly of Germans, off to Bennington, because he knows that there are horses and food and fodder there, and they get hammered. That whole detachment is destroyed at Bennington. So he finds himself, Burgoyne does, at the end of a very long supply line, increasingly desperate. He doesn't know where Howe is, and then he figures out that Howe has actually gone in the other direction. He's hoping that maybe he'll get some help from the residual forces in New York. That's not going to happen. What happens is two battles at Saratoga, one in September, one in October 1777. The first is kind of a draw. And the British hold the ground at the end of the day, and they can claim victory if they want. The second one is an absolute defeat for the British. And they're trapped there at Saratoga. They're surrounded. And all 8,000 of those troops who have come out of Canada are going to be destroyed, either killed or captured. Most of them are going to end up initially in prison camps outside of Boston, and then they're going to be marched all the way to Charlottesville. That's a long way in the winter. And they're going there because the Americans want them out of reach of British raiders. And many of them are going to spend the rest of the war in Charlottesville. So this is the dynamic of what's happening on the battlefield here that affects the dynamic of what's happening in Europe, particularly in Paris and Versailles.
I'm certainly not going to ask you to summarize your 800-page first volume. However, what's interesting is bringing us to 1777, the British throughout this time are trying to find their footing once again, right? They're right. Trying to, a dent has been made, and they are trying to get back on track.
Correct, yes. They're trying to find their footing right from the first gunshots on April 19, 1775 at Lexington and Concord. And they never do really find their footing. They're false dawns for them. And they have they go through a sequence of strategic plans. And none of them are really going to be successful for them. So they decide, after the fiasco of Burgoyne's army being destroyed at Saratoga, and Howe taking Philadelphia, but who cares? Congress, as usual, they hear gunshots and they run. The first time they've gone to Baltimore, this time they go to York. You capture Philadelphia, it's a nice place to spend the winter. Washington and his army are spending the winter 20 miles west of Philadelphia under very difficult conditions at Valley Forge. But Philadelphia is, you know, it doesn't matter. It's not like capturing Berlin. And so the British then come up with a plan that is the so-called Southern Strategy. They believe there are a number of strategic misconceptions the British have. One of them is that of the 2.5 million Americans in the 13 colonies when the war begins, 500,000 of them are enslaved blacks. So of the 2 million white Americans, a majority of them are actually loyalists, that they are secret patriots, that there's this residual American aspiration to remain part of the British Empire, and that all the British need to do is to somehow tap that and unleash it. That's wrong. It's a fatal misconception. But they believe that if they can begin to roll up the colonies from the south, where they believe that there are a lot of loyalists, loyal to the crown, that they can take Georgia, they can take back South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, and begin to roll up the insurrection that way. It doesn't work. They take Savannah, and the Americans and the French in an attack on Savannah, it's a bloody repulse. It's a terrible battle for us. And they're going to take Charleston. This book ends with the British capturing Charleston and the 5,000-man army, American army, that's in Charleston. And that's a real body blow for the cause. But the idea that they're then going to spread through South Carolina and into North Carolina, that's not going to work. So they're constantly looking for a strategic plan that will get them where they want to go, and they never find one.
Well, we start to see glimpses of the turn, right? As this book concludes, we start to see what you're setting up for this last hurrah, if you will.
It's no secret the battle that really ends the war is in October 1781 at Yorktown, where the British, again, have an army trapped and destroyed. Now, the war is going to go on for 2 years after Yorktown, partly because the king is so stubborn that he is really resisting making terms with the Americans and the French and the Spanish and the Dutch, who are all in the war at this time. So there's going to be, and people are getting killed in those last 2 years of the war, but that's volume three. We're not going to go there now.
As far as in the writing, I mean, obviously you know what the history is of volume three, but are you setting yourself up even with outlining and how it's going to unfold?
Sure. I mean, I have a cast of characters, and I have the privilege of going back to them again, now through two volumes, and certainly into the third volume, many of them will be the same. I mean, take George III, for example. Let's talk about our last king for just a minute, if we can. He's not the royal brute that Thomas Paine calls him in Common Sense, which was published in January 1776. He's not the tyrant that Jefferson calls him in the Declaration of Independence. He's not the sinister ninny who prances across the stage in Hamilton every night. He's a constitutional monarch. He's a patriot king. He's a child of the Enlightenment, who's a great patron of the arts and the sciences. He's got a lot going for him. You know, I've spent a lot of time with him now, partly thanks to Queen Elizabeth II. In late 2015, the Queen, then still alive, obviously, opened up to outside scrutiny the Georgian papers, which she owns as a project to digitize and catalog the papers of all four Georges who became king in the 18th and 19th centuries. And I was among the first allowed in to take a look for a whole month. It was April of 2016 in Windsor, which is 20 miles west of London. And every day I would show my badge at the Henry VIII gate to get into the castle, and then my badge again at the Norman gate, and I would climb 102 stone steps and 21 wooden stairs to the garret of the Round Tower begun by William the Conqueror in the 11th century. And there are the papers. And they're in gorgeous, oversized red binders. And George was his own secretary until late in life when he began to go blind. And he not only wrote his correspondence himself, he made the copies himself. And in this trove, there were about 500,000 pages, most from the reign of George III, because he was king for almost 60 years, and most of them previously unpublished. So for me, an archive rat, this gives me, it's a real tactile sense of being in his presence. He married an obscure, drab German princess, Charlotte, as in Charlotte, North Carolina, Charlottesville, Virginia. She learned to play God Save the King on the harpsichord on the voyage to England from Germany, and they married 6 hours after they met. He had the marriage bedroom decorated with 700 yards of blue damask and large basins of goldfish because, Joe, nothing says I love you like a bowl of goldfish.
No.
And it's a loving marriage, which is not always the case with 18th century monarchs. She produces children with lunar regularity, eventually number 15, and he's a caring father. You see this in the correspondence. So, trying to understand his perspective, why he's persisting, why he's stubbornly waging war against his own people for all 8 years, and that's, he's going to be with me for that third volume. He's going to be with me to the brutal end, along with this huge cast who are all struggling one way or another to bring this thing to a resolution.
In the execution of this, in writing for you, where... Look, this is all hard work, and as you said, as you indicated, it's a long process and it's arduous. Is there one part of it that you enjoy perhaps more than another, or is it all very, very fruitful and something that is because those are parts of the process that are enjoyable all the way around?
I like being here with you all. Well, I've made a living as a writer since I was 22, and that was a long time ago. And it's very solitary. There's no way around it. It's you and the blank screen. I like doing what I'm doing when I'm doing it. So the research phase, I usually spend about 3 years researching. I'm engrossed in that. And then I put a mark on the wall, on the calendar, and I say, okay, that's it. I'm going to stop there. You can wander into the woods and never wander out. And then it's time to start putting it together. And I then spend 6 to 8 months building a huge outline of what I've gathered in terms of materials and how it fits together in the book. And I'm an old newspaper man, so I type fast, and I write about 1,000 words a day. And this book is 260,000 words, so if you're writing 1,000 words a day, you can get that done in about a year. And I enjoy doing that because that's the creative part of it. You know, that's where I am trying to turn history into art, frankly. I have high aspirations for what I'm doing. But then when I'm finished, I'm happy to be out to, you know, talk to people about it.
What makes the history art?
I mean, my ambition is, first of all, to bring back the dead. I think that's what every narrative writer is trying to do who's writing about things historically. You know, David McCullough had a wonderful phrase, the great biographer, that in good narrative writing, there's no such thing as a foreseeable future. And I want the reader not to know what's going to happen, even though you know what's going to happen. We're here, we're independent. But I want the reader's imagination to be empowered. I want the reader to not only see it, to hear it, to smell it, to feel it. That is when I think you begin to transform history into art, when the reader's imagination is playing on the words on the page in a way that they have become engrossed in the story.
Rick Atkinson's second book in his Revolution trilogy is The Fate of the Day. It is published by Crown. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Thanks to the staff and crew at Northshire Bookstore in Saratoga Springs. Special thanks to Rachel Person. Write to us at book@wamc.org. Northshire.com for more information about Northshire Bookstore. The latest national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter on WAMC.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Rick Atkinson, a great pleasure to have you before this audience. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. It was my pleasure.
For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.